Okay, we're now going to camera 14.
It's got it work.
With Jerry Cohen.
Jerry, could you actually, sometimes you...
To repeat, we're going to camera 14. This is the interview with Jerry Cohen.
I believe...
Okay, so tell us about what happens in the car.
Well, at one point, Bobby looked at... Jim was driving, and Bobby looks around. And he says, well, what do you say to a guy on a fast? And basically, our response was, you know, just talk to him. Everything will work out fine. I thought he was a little bit nervous, but, you know, I mean, here's a guy that's a U.S. senator and a Kennedy, so how nervous could he have been?
And the crowd is pretty enthusiastic about Kennedy, and people have said that they think that was when Bobby made his decision about Lincoln.
Bobby, I did not go back in the car with him to the airport, but Jim Drake told me that Bobby said that he was going to run for president. And that's the first we'd heard about it, but I don't know if that was one of the precipitating factors or not. That's one of the myths that people in the Farm Workers Union like to tell, but I'm not sure we can hit that one too hard.
But even so, the Farm Workers were the first union to endorse.
Yes, they were. And that's also very interesting because the AFL didn't want us to endorse. So, you know, I remember once in Filipino Hall, Caesar and I crawled out a window to get away from Irwin to Shetler to go out to the 40 acres to have a meeting to talk about endorsing Bobby Kennedy. Because, you know, once in a while the AFL would treat us as if they were babysitting for us. And remember, Meany was a big fan of the war, and we weren't. And Caesar was taking his time because he wanted to keep a coalition of labor and religious people together. But remember, body bags were starting to show up in rural California, and he knew he had to move. It was pretty clear what we were going to do as soon as Bobby announced. We needed to endorse him. And as a matter of fact, as you know, a lot of people went to East L.A. to work.
Yeah. And that really represented a potentially incredibly strong turning point if it had happened. Right?
Oh, it was. No, Kennedy was on a roll. Before he was assassinated, he was really moving. And, you know, Gene McCarthy maybe won Oregon, but Kennedy was picking up momentum. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's move ahead now. After Kennedy is assassinated, the farm workers were really good. They were good at victory parties, but they were good at saying, well, we lost this one, let's move on. So they got back to the boycott after that, right?
Yes. First we went down to Coachella, and there was some strike activity in Coachella, and people went right back. The people that had come out to help on the political campaign went right back to the cities, and they began to develop, you know, the kinds of coalitions between religious groups and labor that were really the guts of a boycott. Pesticides started to become an issue, and I think it's kind of interesting because I don't think people give the Farm Workers Movement enough credit for being one of the first, you know, institutions, the union, to raise the issue of pesticides. And basically, you know, in 67, when Jessica Govea was working in the service center, she brought some women to our attention who were suffering from nausea and headaches, vomiting. And the foreman said, these are the results of heat exhaustion. But Jessica's had worked in the cotton when she was a little girl and said, no, this is pesticides. And so we began to investigate what was going on with pesticides. And I went down to the agricultural commissioner's office at one point to try to get the records as to what was being sprayed. And this guy Morley said, come back in the afternoon. And by the time I came back, they had arranged to get an injunction from something called the Atwood Aviation Corporation preventing me from seeing the records. So then we had an issue of what are they hiding. And Senator Mondale had some hearings in 69, which I think were very important because they raised the issue of pesticides. And it became part of the story that people like Marcos Munoz and Eliseo Medina and Jessica told on the boycott. And I think it was an integral part of the success of the boycott. We were really lucky in those hearings because I had asked the guys on the boycott in Washington, Mike Vasquez and Gene Boutillier, to bring some grapes in. And we brought some grapes while we were testifying and gave them to Mondale as an exhibit. And it showed that Bianco had used Aldrin on the grapes. But Bianco came back. He's one of the grape growers. He said, we don't use Aldrin. This guy's lying or he's doctored the grapes. And then Senator Murphy wanted to throw me in jail for contempt of Congress for doctoring these grapes. And Mondale said, well, let's let this thing play out. Let's find out what happened. We'll have another hearing. And what happened is We told him to take the grapes to the lab that Safeway used to test the grapes, and it turns out you test for this stuff on something called a gas chromatograph, and the spike on the graph for Aldrin was just like sulfur. They had used sulfur. So obviously you can't tell the difference between a chlorinated hydrocarbon that's banned and sulfur. And so then Murphy at the second hearing had to apologize, which then gave us a lot of credibility. And we were running around then saying, well, look, they test the grapes and they say they're not using this stuff, but the tests don't distinguish between sulfur, which they can use, and this chlorinated hydrocarbon, which they can't. And, you know, people like Dolores ran around the country going nuts on the issue of pesticides. So I think it was really useful. And it was very useful that Senator Murphy attacked us.
And really, you know, I mean, Rachel Carson might have been writing about the silent spring, but the farm workers were way ahead of the curve in terms of talking about environmental issues.
Well, you know, it's one thing to write about something academically or write a book, but when you have somebody using the issue as an organizing tool, you know, you're generating some real controversy over that particular point, and you're engaging people. And it was not only an issue, it was a perfect issue when you think about it, because it affects farm workers in the fields.
Once more, but mention pesticides, because we don't know what the issue is.
Oh, the issue of pesticides is an issue that is, when you use it on the boycott, what you're doing is you're engaging consumers in their own self-interest, because misuse of pesticides affects farm workers in the fields, and it can affect the consumers who eat the, you know, in this case, the grapes or any crop on which pesticides have been dumped. And it was really the first time, I think, that issue became a national issue. And I just think that those workers who raised that are never given enough credit for the fact that this is way back in the 60s, and they're talking about pesticides. And finally, what are we now, 2006, people are realizing, yeah, pesticides can cause cancer. And remember, when you start doing studies, there are a lot of cancer clusters in the Central Valley, and people don't quite know how to account for them. And it's very hard when you take these medical experts for the Shell Oil Company or Dow or whoever creates the pesticides to prove it in court, but there is a correlation between where people live and the kind of diseases they have. And one of the cruel ironies of this is that Jessica herself, you know, died of breast cancer. And to me, she was the first person inside the union to raise this issue with some, you know, insistence and clarity.
So moving towards the end of 69 and into 70,
yeah,
it feels like there's finally some sort of critical mass. I mean, in order for a boycott to win, you don't have to get all the people in the country to stop eating. You have to get enough so that they...
No, it's not an election. You don't need a majority. You need an active minority. And we never quite knew what that minority was, but we were pretty clear that we had it, because chain stores were raising hell. They wanted to enjoin us. Growers were griping. There were some false starts in 69. We had some meetings in Los Angeles with the Federal Mediation Service. And basically, ironically, the meetings fell apart over the issue of putting pesticide language in the contracts. You know, there are some regulations in the state. You know, for instance, if you use something called an organophosphate, you don't let a worker in the fields for 21 days, but they weren't enforced. So what we wanted to do is tell the growers, let's just take these regulations, put them right in the contract, and if you violate it, we have the grievance procedure to use. Those negotiations fell apart. The first real feelers we got were out of Coachella in the late winter and early spring of 70, and that's where we got our first contracts. The first one was with Charles Friedman, Lionel Steinberg. And then we got a contract with, I think, K.K. Larson. And the interesting thing about those contracts is that they made the boycott more effective. One of our fears, because we didn't know how this would work, is when you're boycotting the whole crop, what happens if you have some grapes that are union and some grapes that are non-union? Does that blow a big hole in the boycott? But what happened is that the grapes that had the union label, remember our label was the little black bird, those grapes sold like hotcakes and at a premium. You know, it's like the Maltese Falcon, you know, everybody wanted the black bird. Remember Bogart saying that? Well, everybody wanted the black bird. And I remember going into a Tenneco shed in the Coachella Valley, and there were these non-union grapes stacked up to the ceiling, and union grapes were selling. And that kicked in an economic dynamic that caused those other growers to want to get that union label. And we thought we were negotiating. You know, there was a guy named Henry Ryder, from something called Coachella Imperial Distributors. I met him in a motel, And I showed him the contract, and I said, Henry, you want to read this contract? And his response was, Cohen, I ain't no legal asshole. I just want that union label. And that was real power.
So they didn't get to that point happily, right?
No. They didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart, you know. For example, you know, when you think of the, well, that's Coachella, right? When you think of, then that builds a certain base of union grape that's moving. But we still have the big nut to crack, right? Delano. And I remember one Saturday night, this to me was, you know, the most important phone call I ever got in my life. John Jamara Jr. called. And he said that he and his dad were going to go on a trip and they were going to kick the hell out of the union. And then they might want to talk to us. And I said, well, go on your trip. Do whatever you want to do and talk. And he said, but maybe it'd be a good idea if we talked to you before we went on the trip. And I said, well, what do you mean, John? This was like 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. He said, my dad and I want to meet with you. And I said, when? Tonight. And then it struck me that, oh, boy, something's going on. This is the biggest grape grower. He was calling from his 10th high school reunion, and he wanted to meet. And I called Helen because Caesar was on the road, and I said, as soon as Caesar gets back, have him call me because Jamara wants to meet. And when Caesar got back, we decided we'd meet him at the Stardust Hotel, room 44 of the Stardust Hotel, as a matter of fact. And on the way over, we were kind of nervous because we knew Jamara was interested, but what we wanted to do is force him to bring everybody to the table. Our position was, if there's going to be enough heat on Jamara, let's get him to round up all 29 Delano growers and settle this at the heart of the grape industry right now. And we weren't quite sure whether that would happen or not. And we got to the hotel, to the motel room, and Jamara said that he could round up those growers. And then the next day we met at the St. Mary's School with the whole Delano table grape industry. But I remember Jamara telling Caesar, you know, this little Sicilian put up one hell of a fight. You must love me a lot, Caesar, because you paid me a lot of attention. And I thought the guy was, you know, pretty basic and pretty down to earth. And once they decided to settle, that negotiation moved very fast. We had a contract in a couple of days.
What did that moment represent?
To me, it represented like the vindication of what Caesar had been advocating. It was nonviolence that worked. It was the boycott that worked. Nobody had boycotted a crop like that before in this country. It was the perseverance of all those folks that went out, because what really won this, when you think about it, is the stories that farm workers told. When somebody like Marcos Munoz leaves the fields and goes to Boston, excuse me, you know, he didn't even, he wasn't even able to read those street signs. So he navigated around Boston by memorizing buildings on corners. But when he told his story to people, they understood they were listening to something that was real. And I think it was the power of those stories and basically appealing to better instincts in people that won that. It was a hell of a victory. And I remember, you know, and it stays with you. When Caesar died, my first thought was, I'm going to go back to that Stardust Motel. And a bunch of us did, because what it symbolized was, here are a bunch of folks that basically started out with nothing that brought this big industry to its knees with a boycott. And that hadn't been done before.
And in the process, it not only changed the industry, but those people were different people now, weren't they?
It was a school for people. When you think of what people learned and what they then did with their lives, you know, they've been crucial in the labor movement. They're labor lawyers all over this country that got their training there. It was a real school for us. And to me, that was Caesar at his best, because he was never negative if you were trying. You could go and lose a battle, but if you were trying, you know, he would encourage people like Eliseo and people like Marcos or Jessica or the lawyers or anybody. As long as you were trying to fight, he was behind you. And there was a real source of strength there, and it was a real community, and it worked. And not that kind of power doesn't get generated by disenfranchised and powerless people very often in this country, and that's a good example of how it can work if you're persistent.
And in the process, they all of a sudden they weren't disenfranchised.
No, we had power. All of a sudden, we had, what did we have after that? Ranch committees. What were the ranch committees? They were the people that were there to enforce those contracts. Growers, it was like putting a saddle on a bucking bronco. those growers had never had to account for their behavior before, and now they had to account. And they had to account because there was a mechanism that forced them to account, namely the contract and the grievance procedure in the contracts.
Stop for a second. So let's go back to the beginning again, just briefly. What did it mean to you personally to be fresh out of law school and all of a sudden, you know, you might have missed the civil rights movement, but you'd heard about it and you had this sense that law could really change things. All of a sudden, you're part of something.
I knew it was a sort of a lucky break to be there. And I knew Caesar was gambling because here's you're taking somebody right out of law school. But I think what he saw was somebody who liked to fight. And I think that was the most important thing in his mind. I remember the first thing he had me do was go to the Rio Grande Valley because there was a melon strike down there. And he said, see what you can do about this because the Texas Rangers are beating people up. And he said, and if you want our help, I'll come down. And I went down there, and I realized that there were civil rights violations going on. And I knew a little bit about how to put a complaint together. But what I did was go to lawyers that had some experience, a guy named Chris Dixie, who represented the United Auto Workers. And we worked together on putting a complaint together to stop the Rangers from basically pounding on people. But that was going to take time. So I called Caesar and asked him to come down because he said, if you need help, come on, you know, I'll come down and help. Gilbert Padilla was in charge of the strike. It was a melon strike. It had been started prematurely, and people really weren't ready for the consequences of a strike in rural Texas. And what happened is a guy named Magdaleno Dimas went out to shoot a chachalaca bird, and for his troubles, since it was out of season, they beat him up and fractured his skull. And people, this is again an example of nonviolence, people were really upset, and they wanted to shoot it up with the Rangers. And Caesar came and said, look, it's going to take Jerry time to get the legal redress, but in the meantime, just give me a couple of days. And he said, we'll show these bastards the power of prayer. And every night, the Rangers, it was like out of a Western, they stayed at a place called the Ringgold Hotel, and they would walk across this little road to eat at this catfish inn. And one night, Caesar had all of Magdaleno Dimas' women dressed in black, kneeling and praying for the Rangers' souls. And the next day, Governor Connally got those bastards out of town. Now, I felt comfortable in that environment because I realized, you know, you're working with somebody who I thought was, I could tell this guy is really an organizational and political genius. I can learn a lot. He's going to give me time to experiment and fumble around. So I'll just learn what to do. And then the other thing that caused me to learn is that some of these grower lawyers, like Jamar's lawyer, was really good. And, you know, I sort of learned by trial and error. I'd go to court and I'd watch Quinlan. He was very good. And so you began to learn, you know, it's like, it was like immersion, you know, you either swim or you drown. And luckily, you know, with the kind of support that people like Caesar gave me, you know, I was able to swim.
So you're going through that same process of taking command and realizing that you can change things too.
Yes. You do realize that you can have an effect. I mean, once we figured out that scheme for the United Peanut Shelling Workers of America, you realize just looking at something with fresh eyes gave us an opportunity because when we got those covered workers out, what did that do? That gave us the power to secondary boycott. That was one of the foundation stones of being able to boycott. So just sort of fumbling around and learning together. And Caesar, you know, when Caesar said, I don't know anything, we'll learn it together, he was, you know, he knew a lot. But he had a way, I think he would size up different people individually. Some people he sort of needed to lecture to. Other people all he needed to do was ask questions and give him a little rope, little room to move and a little encouragement. And that's what he did with me. I think that's the mark of a really good teacher, and I think in those days Caesar was. So I didn't feel, maybe it's because I was too young and stupid to realize it, but I didn't feel a lot of pressure. You know, I just felt we'll experiment and see what works and what doesn't work. Yeah.
But looking back, you're sort of amazed at how it all worked.
Looking back, I don't understand how it happened. Right. I was in my 20s, right? And maybe that was a good thing. Maybe if you learn more and you're more conservative, maybe we wouldn't have filed all the lawsuits we filed or wouldn't have raised all the hell we raised. But, you know, you did have a sense of community in Delano. So, you know, you could go down and lose a motion in Bakersfield, come back, and Caesar's position was nothing we do here is fatal. We can turn something good out of anything bad. And one of the interesting confrontations Caesar and I had also taught me something. There was an injunction, which it was at Jamar, as a matter of fact. It deprived us of our right to have bullhorns. And Jessica was working with me in the legal department then, and we had a few books, and I went up to the appellate court on this writ to try to get our bullhorns back, but I had filed the wrong writ. And so this kindly judge says, you got a really great argument here, young man, but you got to file it on a different writ. And I came back and told Caesar we were going to go back up on the writ. 2 days later, I come marching into his office and say, look, Caesar, I got the writ. We got our bullhorns back. And Caesar says, damn it to hell. I was going to go violate that and get thrown in jail. And I said, well, you know, maybe you better level with me because once in a while I just might win, you know. So from that point on, he was very clear, you know, with me about what his tactics were. So, you know, I didn't go and inadvertently win something and get bullhorns back when he wanted to go to jail over the use of bullhorns. So those are the kinds of things that happened, and you know, sort of learn that way.
Sure. And he would figure out what motivated people. That is to say, he learned what was a challenge for you. But I'm thinking about all these strikers that went off. You know, Marcos Munoz thought he was going to Barstow, and he goes.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. So, and Eliseo didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
He basically told people, I think, the same thing that he would tell somebody like me, which is, don't worry about failing. Just try. We don't know how to get this done, but we will experiment until we figure it out. And he was very supportive of anybody who was working. He was very intolerant of people who made excuses. You know, I can't do this. The city's too big. The religious people don't like the labor people. And basically his argument was, we got to figure out common ground so we get the religious community and the liberal Democrats and even liberal Republicans and the labor people working together. And he would go to various cities and show up and support people the same way he supported me in the legal work in the kitchen of the Pink House. Yeah.
Of the war, the anti-war.
Oh yeah, let's talk about coalition of what the country was like. I mean, the '60s, you know, looking back, was a special time.
Yes, it was.
People were engaged on a number of fronts. The country was.
Yes, it was.
Feeling the response to the war, they'd gone through the civil rights movement, and then this is added to the pot. Talk about what the times were like then.
Well, when you think of the times, and I was luckily placed in Berkeley, I think I would have gone nuts in law school without Berkeley, because first we had the free speech movement, then we had the anti-Vietnam demonstrations, and I think that gave young people a real sense that they could do something. We knew we were generating a lot of pressure and power on the government about Vietnam. And it also, you know, think of the times in terms of how fertile they were for somebody that's a really good organizer like Caesar. He was able to tap into a lot of that energy because when you brought students and religious people into the boycott mechanism, what you were asking them to do was something very specific. You know, you have a meeting with the chain store, you picket the chain store, you leaflet the neighborhood, you talk to the people in the churches and in the synagogues, and you begin to build that power. And people could see that their daily activities were making a difference. Well, you saw that on big issues like the war, and you saw it on discrete issues like the Great Boycott. So that it was a fertile time to have something like this succeed. That doesn't mean that it can't be done again. You know, I get pretty impatient with people that say, well, you did the Great Boycott because it was the 60s. You can't duplicate that. But I think the lesson really is not that so much as the fact that if you get people that are dedicated and are willing to fight, there are a lot of things that you can change, no matter what the times are.
But there needs to be a motivation, and Caesar was a key ingredient.
Caesar was appealing. Well, there are different kinds of motivation in there. There's the motivation of the farm workers. And what you're basically telling the workers going on the boycott is, we can't win this just on the grower turf. We also can't win this if we define it as a fight about race. This is a fight in which we have to build a big coalition. It's not about race. It's about generating economic power. And it's in your interest to go out there, because if we can stop the sale of those grapes, we then have the pressure on the growers to get a contract which is going to benefit you. Then when you look at students and other people that want to do work, he was offering them an opportunity to spend at least a part of their lives doing something during which they could really have an impact and help make change. And I think Caesar was pretty astute in assessing what motivated different people. And, you know, he was the kind of guy, like any good politician, when he was engaged with people, you know, I was in meetings with him many times, he's engaged with somebody, and those people talking to him are convinced that at that point, they're the most important person in the world to Cesar Chavez. That's the kind of talent that he had. Yeah.
So you can't just snap your fingers and recreate that.
You can't recreate the specific people that were involved, but what you can recreate is a sense, I think, of the kind of dedication and purpose it takes to win fights. You need leadership, and there are plenty of fights out there to be fought, right?
When we're in 1968, Martin Luther King,
let's talk about
losing everyone
else.
And what the sense, the feeling was.
Whether people were really worried about Caesar.
Yes. Well, 68 was not only a very good year because of the fast, but it was a tragic year because Martin Luther King is murdered and Bobby Kennedy is worried. I mean, murdered, and we are worried. Yeah, Martin Luther King is murdered.
Talk about 1968.
All right. In 1968, you know, we had the positive of the fast and the impact it had on farm workers. But at the same time, you know, you have the war going on, you have Bobby Kennedy assassinated, Martin Luther King assassinated, and there were, as early as 68, rumors that there were plots against Caesar. A few years later, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and people were worried about Caesar's health and welfare and his safety because of those things. A few years later, I think it's 71, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms calls, and Caesar asked Andy Anzaldúa and I to go meet them. We met him in Santa Maria, and they gave us a picture of a guy, his name was Buddy Jean Prochnow, who they claimed had been hired to shoot Caesar. And it turned out that Prochnow had done an assassin kind of hit for, I think, $750 in Visalia. And so at that point, it became a real practical internal issue. What do you do about it? And that was the point at which, various people said, you know, you're going to have somebody drive you. You're going to have some people around you all the time. And Caesar was at first, naturally so, just very reluctant to do that because he wanted his freedom. But after a debate inside, you know, people started staying with Caesar 24 hours a day.
But the moment in 1968 shows that leaders are vulnerable.
Oh, not only are leaders vulnerable, but there are specific threats to leaders. Richard Chavez, his brother, and I drove to a place up north of Marysville because somebody had been talking in a bar about a plot to kill Caesar. By the time we got there, the cops had gotten custody of the guy and stuck him in a hospital, and we couldn't have access to him. So there were rumors swirling around about that. So it's not only generally that leaders are vulnerable and specifically that two leaders were dead, but there were specific threats about Caesar at that point.
Funny situation. So much positive energy at the same time.
Yeah. Well, he didn't let it bother him. I mean, he didn't let it inhibit him. He went to rallies. He wasn't a fatalist. You know, he wasn't the kind of guy to say, you know, when my number's up, it's up. He wanted to take practical steps to be as safe as he could, but he was not going to let it interfere with his ability to run that union. And I don't think he did.
One last thing, again, about how it's possible people who have nothing are able to come together and get this sense of power and really make change. Because I think that's an important message.
Yeah.
For now.
Especially for young people. Young people feel very alienated.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the continuing lessons of any fight that ends in a victory is that people who are disenfranchised and powerless, if they come together and if they have a sense of purpose, can make a difference. And I think part of the attitude that was so important in those days was that none of us thought we had anything to lose. And it takes some leadership. And it takes some dedication. But when you think of the fact that farm workers came out of the fields, you know, many without an education, some, like Marcos, without being able to read, they go to an entirely new place like Boston, and just by telling their own story to people, they convince people to join a cause. If somebody out of the fields, poor, can do that, any student who's committed to, you know, a certain cause should be able to do it as well.
Well, we're waiting.
I think we got it.
Okay.
It's a very good lesson.
I think
kids out there that are hungry, I think high school kids listening to this stuff.
Oh, I do. Yeah, I agree. I agree. You know, if there were a draft, there wouldn't be any war in Iraq.
Obviously.
And that's why there ain't no draft,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, what you got to do is get past that point of self-interest to see what the hell you can do about it.